It works. Good morning, everybody, and welcome to our first talk of the festival. It's a thrill to see so many of you here, and lots of good things on our schedule for the next couple of days. We'll triumph over the train strike. That's not going to affect anything. I'm in denial. It's good. our first speaker this morning, we're thrilled to have Shirley Day with us, who's a novelist and a screenwriter. She teaches for Southern Florida University, Florida State University, I'm so sorry, and is pursuing a doctorate at East Anglia. And she's going to speak to us this morning about Graham Greene and film adaptation. And of course, films are a huge part of our festival. So with that, I give you Shirley Day.
Thank you so much for that introduction, Richard. And I want to thank the Birthplace Trust for inviting me here today to speak. And thank you all for coming. It's obviously something that we're all, Graham Greene is something we're all very passionate about. So we all have that in common. So I hope that you will like what I've found while I've been looking around for my PhD. So why me? Why would I do a PhD in Graham Greene and adaptation? Okay, well, this is me. So I started off actually I went to drama school, trained as an actress for 3 years, and then I wrote short stories for radio. Then I got into screenwriting, and you've got some of the screenplays down there on my IMDb. They are all awful, so I wouldn't, of the features, I would not watch any of them. And I thought that was quite interesting. That was why I was excited to look at Green, one of the reasons, which I'll get back to. So recently I've started more writing novels, actually, because it's simpler, it's much easier to keep control of it, and it's only you and the audience. So I've sort of taken a step back into that. I still do work as a script consultant, so I work for the literary consultancy, and I work for a number of production companies. And we just heard yesterday that one of the screenplays that I was working on has been greenlit, so that's all exciting. But mainly now I write novels, and I also am adjunct professor at, it's actually 4 universities, so Florida State University is the main one, and they have a London campus. And so I started off working for there, actually teaching screenwriting. And then I transferred over because after post-pandemic, they took that module back to the States. So now I teach theatre in London, which is a really nice course, actually. We get to go to all the shows in London. I'm doing that for 4 different American universities in the UK. So that's sort of a bit of my background. And I have written... I actually can't remember how many novels I've actually written at the moment, but I think there are about 6 published so far, and another one coming out soon. But these two really are the ones that you're going to be interested in, because they are ones that have a Graham Greene element in it. And it is quite a small element, but it's definitely there. So The Insect House was actually originally, it was a screenplay, and it got almost to the last point with the BFI for film funding, but it didn't get it. So this is going back like 20 years. This is a long time ago. And then it was a play, and it was performed, and it won a couple of awards. And then, about 5 years ago, maybe longer, I adapted it as a novel. So that one is the Graham Greene element in it is, and I know that you'll all remember England Made Me, the character who steals the show is Minty, for me anyway, and I think for Graham Greene it was as well. And Minty has this very curious habit of trapping insects underneath glasses. And I thought that was really a curious habit, and I wanted to use that. So I used that in The Insect House, and I've given an explanation as to why a person might do that. Not Minty, another person. So it's gone off in a completely different sort of direction. And it's really about parental neglect more than the actual idea of trapping an insect under a glass. So that's the Insect House, and then I've got Reap What You Sow, which is a little bit like Dr. Fisher of Geneva in that it centres on a man who feels he can buy people. So slightly different. And when I wrote that particular one, I thought, this is so far-fetched. No one would actually do this, what he actually does in the book. And then it came out on the news that somebody had actually done it. So a life mirroring fiction there. So why, let's talk about a little bit about adaptation, because my PhD is about Graham Greene and adaptation, and it's really about Graham Greene and film rather than theatre, so it's just that one sort of transition. And adaptation is actually a really complex theoretical discipline. It shouldn't be, but it is, and to use a terminology of Greene, it's a bit of a battlefield. So we're not actually going to get too much involved in adaptation here, but I thought it'd be just interesting to just look at some of the problems. So the earliest use of the word adaptation is in 1799, and that's in the Oxford English Dictionary. And the whole adaptation field has just boomed recently, and that's partly due to all the different platforms. We consume so much more. There are so many more ways of producing material. So it really has boomed. But it is, as I said, a problematic theoretical discipline. And that's really because people often see it as an adjunct of literary theory. So they see it as quite a new theory, a new discipline. It has actually been going on, although the word, we've only got it there in 1799, even as long as people could tell stories have been adapted. And when we think back to the festivals in Greece, the Dionysian festival, they would have been telling stories that everyone knew, but they just changed a little bit every year. So sometimes the difference is the thing that we're looking for in adaptation, not just fidelity. And fidelity is often part of the problem, because often an appraisal of adaptation becomes a discussion as to how far a film has or has not been faithful to the source. So there you've got, implicit in that, you've got a bias. You've got the source as the original text, as some people might say the superior text. So it doesn't give you a lot of room to play with. And the other problem with adaptation theory is authorial intent. So Wismat and Beardsley in the 1940s produced something called the intentionalist fallacy, and they said you cannot know what the author intended. It's impossible. Even if the author is there in the room with you, sometimes they don't know. They don't know the influences that are surrounding it. And so it can actually be a problem. And also, of course, adaptations are not just fixed in time, they change. So this is Malcolm Bradbury here. He said, an adaptation, like the work it adapts, is always framed in a context, a time and place, a society and culture. So they are constantly changing. So just like the Greeks enjoyed that change, if we're looking for fidelity in an adaptation, we're trying to seal it in place, and that may not work. So these are just a few of the problems as to why an adaptation theory is problematic. So why Greene? Why would I think, okay, who would be a good person to study here? And I think most of us know the answers slightly to that one. So Greene belonged to the first generation of British workers who grew up with movies, and his work was deeply influenced by the new medium. So that's David Lodge saying that. And in his own words, in Greene's own words, he had deliberately set out to write a book which, with luck, might be made into a film, and that was about Istanbul Train. So he really was thinking cinematically. He adapted his own work as well as adapting the work of others. So there's very few people at that point in time who were doing that, and it's a real skill. He was also employed in the literary and film industry, so he was a reviewer. So he had an analytical perspective on what worked in a film and what didn't. So I thought foolishly, when I set out to do my PhD and I put in my research proposal, I said I was really interested in how Green, with his very succinct, very controlled writing, could actually control adaptations, because I'd seen lots of the films and I thought they were great. So I thought he must be controlling it some way. But of course, how wrong could I be? So this is from The Times, and this is the 1980s, and this is Green's being interviewed about films. He said that very good films, not very many good films have been made out of my books, so they can't be very cinematic, which I think is a bit heartbreaking. I don't know about all of you, but I feel very sad about that he actually felt that. He had never sat through a complete showing of Travels with My Aunt, but had been sufficiently dismayed by a smuggled copy of the script. He also said that several great directors had been responsible for some of his worst films. So he really, he was not happy with the adaptation process often, and we'll talk about the ones that he was actually happy and why that worked, really. Fritz Lang actually apologised for the 1944 screen version of Ministry of Fear. So even the directors were saying, hang on a minute, this has gone off piste. And Fritz Lang wasn't the only person to apologise. Green praised Carol Reed as the only director that he really felt got to the heart of his films. And so we're going to have a look later at why that might be. So, of course, with a film, it's when I was saying about I've gone back to writing novels, with a film there are so many stakeholders involved. So I'm just going to name a few stakeholders, but if anyone has any that they think, oh yeah, you haven't thought about that, please do grab me and say, because I would be really interested. And I think this is often what drives adaptation stakeholders. So who are the stakeholders? This is what I've got. I've given them all an equal share of the pie. They probably don't have that. I think I need to do some research with the BFI, hopefully, and try and tie down a little bit more detail about how much influence different people have. So first of all, I've put the author, the literary estate. So often when a project is bought by a production studio, you stop having control over that as an author. But of course, you do have the choice to not sell your film to somebody. So of course, Green didn't want to have Hitchcock make his film, so he made that very clear. So you do have that choice. The motivations can be slightly different as to why they might be doing it. So for an author, definitely, it's important. This is work. You need to be paid. For a literary estate as well, they would want to make money, I'm sure. That's a really big thing. But also, as time goes on, it's keeping the name of that writer alive and keeping different works out there. So their objectives can actually change over time. They don't stay necessarily the same. Then there's the adapter who's adapting the script, and often that can be, again, money, because they should be hopefully being paid for it. But often there's that intellectual interest of unpacking the script and digging that little bit deeper and finding out the themes. So those are sort of objectives that an adapter might have. The audience, well, that's really interesting, because for a long time the audience didn't really have a say in what was being adapted at all, how it was being adapted. But now, because of social media, they have much more of a voice. So the audience is beginning to have more of a voice on how things are adapted. The critics and their role, of course, has changed, because now they used to be able to make or break a film, whereas now people are posting their own reviews. So the role of the critic has changed slightly, and it might be now to be able to boil things down succinctly into ways that we just think, wow, they're using language so beautifully there. And I do enjoy reading reviews, and I know that other people do too. So I think now we're looking at that expertise in language, definitely from the critics. The publisher, so what kind of stake do they have it? Well, obviously they want to make money out of their novel that they're representing. They don't know, I don't know if anyone heard recently, there was an interview with the head of Random House, and they said that the reason it was called Random House was because they never knew what was going to be popular. They just had no control over that. So they don't always know the best route for a particular book or project. And then, of course, the funder, and they have a big voice, really, and they have control. And we're going to see how some of the control that the funder has in the production companies has altered the conception of what a particular project means as we go through. And then academia, and please don't tell my supervisor, but I put it right at the last point. But really, they do have a stake in this adaptation process. Because, of course, they hopefully will be training up the next body of adapters, and hopefully we will get the theoretical part of adaptation process sorted, and it can be a really positive experience in a theoretical discipline which works for them. So let's have a quick look at one of the main objectives in all of this, which is follow the money. Green was an absolute pragmatist on this. He knew that he had to be making money from his project. So, and it's very interesting actually, because he was one of the first people to be making money in this field. So he was also, though, frustrated, as we've seen from the review, about the studio intervention, really, and that, you know, that he had no control over. So let's have a look at one of the projects that he was particularly disappointed with. Okay, so this is 21 Days. And this was Green not adapting one of his own stories. He was adapting Galsworthy's short story, which was also a play. So it was a process of him being commissioned to adapt. So he was one of the first people working as a commissioned screenwriter. So Galsworthy's short story, Green's final shooting script, and Corder's distributed film have a similar causal plot. So it's basically two brothers. So it's Larry and Keith. And Larry over here, who's conveniently Laurence Olivier, so we've got the name sort of running through, he's the feckless brother. Keith is the sensible brother. And Keith is a barrister. He is going to be a judge. So he's got his whole life all mapped out for him. But of course, then Larry falls in love with Wanda. Okay. And Wanda is a fallen woman in the novel, in the short story. And then in the film, she's just down on her luck. But the point is that Larry falls for her. She also has an ex-husband in tow who's abusive and estranged, but suddenly he turns up. Larry accidentally kills Wanda's husband. So Larry, who's very moral, he may be a bit feckless, but he does have a moral compass, goes to Keith and says, I've just done something terrible. I've just killed my lover's husband. I didn't mean to do it. I've got to go to the police. Keith doesn't want this to happen because Keith is up for the job of a judge. So he knows this will ruin his career. So he says, well, hold on a minute, you know, what good is it going to do? You going and turning yourself into the police, you'll just be, you know, executed. This man was a waster. We can just get away with, if we don't say anything, there's no evidence against you, you'll be all right. So Larry and Wanda reluctantly take the advice. And it all sort of goes okay until someone else, an innocent man, is actually arrested for the crime. So now it's a problem. In the story, it is a vagrant, and in Green's script, it's a fallen priest disillusioned by his the absence of religion, which actually I think works really well as a narrative device. So that's great. So then we have an innocent man in jail. We have Larry and Wanda totally, you know, guilt-ridden by this. And at this point in time, all three scripts, so all three, so the play, Galsworthy's play and short story, Graham Greene's script, and Corder's finished film, they all the triangulations suddenly start pulling apart a little bit. So in the short story and the play, Wanda and Larry actually are so guilty about this whole thing that they decide that they're going to take a suicide pact, and they drink a volume of poison, and they write a confessional note, and they die in each other's arms, very poetically, a bit Romeo and Juliet-ish. And then, boo hiss, Keith comes in, finds the letter, and burns it. So that's one ending. That was Galsworthy's ending. So then Green's ending is that Larry is running to the police to deliver his confession that he killed Wanda's husband. When the John Bevan, who is the innocent man in jail, actually has a heart attack and dies. But Keith thinks that this is going to be delivered. So Keith thinks, this is the end of my career, I'm guilty of blocking evidence. And so in Graham Greene's script, Keith shoots himself. So in the actual film, of course, Corden knew that that wasn't going to happen. So in the actual film, what happens is there's pressure, really, to have, from the studio, from the public, to have a happy ending. So in the actual film, John Bevan very sadly dies. Larry's running to give his confession. Wanda catches up with him. It's all right, he's dead. So nobody dies, nobody gets shot. And the pistol shot is there in Green's script. Yeah, in Corder's film, it never goes off. It only ever goes off on page 145 in the vaults of the BFI. So I couldn't quite believe it. You know, when you see it and you think, I had to read it about three times. I thought, wow, this is just a different ending. So Green claimed Laurence Olivier and Vivian Leigh had much to forgive him for. They suffered together in the leading parts. So that he says that in Ways of Escape. So he just felt the film was terrible. He actually described it as his worst film. So he also said that the story was particularly unsuited for film adaptation, as its whole point lay in a double suicide, forbidden by the censor, a burned confession, and an innocent man's conviction for murder, which was forbidden by the general public. So as you can see, it was going to be a difficult one to actually get off the ground, maybe from the beginning. But it did actually enable Green to write other screenplays and become very skilled at doing that. So this is actually a page from the script at the BFI, and you can see that it's even broken down into medium close shots with how far the distance of the camera would be. And this is quite amazingly detailed for a script. Even for a shooting script, you would not do that necessarily today, certainly not the author. So the whole screenwriting convention has changed completely. So if someone writes a script now and they even say the camera tilts, that is an absolute no-no. You just don't do it, because you are then taking on the role of the director. So you have to leave all that to the director. But for Graham Greene, when he was writing, it was an incredibly skilled, detailed process. As he wrote to his mother, every camera angle has to be described, each angle being a scene, the average film having about 550 scenes, so it's a long business. He says, I find it very tiring, as you have to visualize exactly the whole time, not merely what the person is doing, but from the angle you want to watch him doing it from. So it's quite incredible when you think of that, when he was actually doing that. So you can see that, are his films, are his novels cinematic? They have to be. You can't go through this sort of training and not actually build that into your novels. There's also a very clever use of transitions in the film, which shows that he was very skilled at what he was doing. So there's Larry's shooting at the fairground dummy, and the dummy fails into the John Bevan, the innocent man. So it's very cleverly sort of manipulated. So despite what Green felt about it, it's a really interesting project to actually look at, and it shows us how he got such amazing training from it. So the other one, which I think is really, really interesting and very, very odd, is Went the Day Well. So this was produced in 1942 by Alberto Cavalcanti. And the story behind this is just absolutely fascinating. It is a very, very strange film, partly because it's pure propaganda, and Cavalcanti also had surrealist leanings, so it's slightly surreal as well. So this is the sort of story behind it. In 1940, the Ministry of Information was concerned with the possibility of German invasion and looking for ways to engage the Americans with what the British government feared was a genuine possibility of invasion. The Americans didn't actually believe that the British would fight back if the Germans invaded. So the Ministry of Information countered this by arranging for unofficial British contributions to American papers. However, releasing propaganda material in the States soon became very difficult. And so at a policy meeting of the 5th of April 1940, it was decided that a literary division of the Ministry of Information should be formed. On the 18th of April of that same year, a policy committee minuted that Mr. Graham Greene had assumed control of the literary section. So it seemed that propaganda could not be printed directly in the papers, but if it was part of a short story, it was fine. So that was the way they got around it, and that is what this is. This is absolute propaganda, and it was written with that in mind. It was actually published as The Lieutenant Dies Last in Collier's Weekly in America, and it was never published in England, which I think is also interesting. So let's have a look at the next slide. I've lost my notes on that one, so I don't know what's happening there. Oh, they're back. So although Michael Balkan of Ealing Studios claimed that Greene had a hand in actually writing the script, that seems really unlikely. And Penelope Houston researched the film extensively. And she says in her book, Went the Day Well, which is in the BFI collection of classics, that there was no evidence of this. And I think when you read it, you can tell that it's not very Greene-like. So it seems very unlikely that he was involved. Initially, two writers were employed to actually adapt the script or adapt the story. But when it came to, I think it was a couple of weeks before, they realized there were problems and they brought in Diana Morgan, and she had to actually rewrite the film as they were shooting it, because it was just completely all over the place. So it's quite an interesting story of how that one developed and why, I think. And another one, so we're going forward slightly in time here, 1957. I'm going to bring you back again, but for the moment, let's just push on, because this was another commission that Greene had. So I wanted to just look briefly at The Burning of St. Joan, which I haven't actually watched, and I haven't seen the script yet. But it's just an interesting one. It was directed by Otto Preminger, who also directed The Human Factor. Neither of the films that Otto Preminger directed were particularly successful. And this one, The Burning of St. Joan, was, I don't know if it was a box office flop, but it was considered a bad production. The failure of the film actually stalled Jean Seberg's career, so she was the leading lady in it. And he auditioned 18,000 women before actually getting to Jean Seberg and casting her. And some of the critics said that she was just inexperienced and couldn't hold her own against the other more experienced actors. I don't know if that's true, because I haven't seen the film. But it was interesting. I found a Times review which said there were some odd omissions, interpolations, and additions, and the result is a certain scrappiness and confusion in the first half of the film of Shaw's slow and careful build-up, because, of course, it was originally a play by George Bernard Shaw. It also said, I'm not sure if this, I think this was the same interview, some of the vocabulary is unusual. It's doubtful that the term cowboy was used in 1300s France. And the phrase, God is on the side of big battalions, quoted in the film, was actually first used by Napoleon Bonaparte more than four centuries after Joan. So there were some historical anomalies. I don't know, does that matter? I think it depends on if you are a historical fiction buff or a film fiction buff. And I'm really curious actually to see this film and see the script. I thought it was really interesting, again, because he was being commissioned to write this as a screenwriter and not writing one of his own works. So we can see how prolific he was and how he moved between different mediums. So as we can see from this, the production process has real restrictions over what the writer and what the artists are doing. And none more so than the production process, which I found really, really fascinating, is For the Man Within, which was by Sydney and Muriel Bock. So I thought we'd have a quick look at this. So this is Attenborough, and this is The Man Within, which was written in 1929. It was actually Graham Greene's first novel. So he wrote it when he was 21, and he did go back and think about editing it many years later, and he opened it and said, I'm not even going to change a comma, and it has to just stand as a testimony to my writing as a younger man. So so it's interesting from that point of view. It's also interesting in that it's a historical piece. It's not contemporary. He's actually doing historical fiction here about smugglers. So that was quite interesting, a very different approach. And it tells the story of Andrews, who is a young lad. This is Andrews here, Attenborough, who... So he is. His father is a smuggler. He's away at boarding school. He doesn't really know that. And then his father dies, and Andrews gets taken under the wing of Carleon Redgrave here, who takes him under his wing and takes him back to the smugglers and acts as a mentor to him. So that all goes pretty well, because at first, Carleon is the father that Andrews never had, so the relationship is great. But as we know, in stories, things go wrong. So what happens is that Andrews steals something, and so Carleon has to punish him in the same way that he would punish the rest of his men. He doesn't want to do it, but because he's only a lad, but he has to do it. And you can see they all look pretty pleased, really, that he's having a whipping. So as you can imagine, Andrews is humiliated by this and disgusted by the smugglers. And he's very resentful, and he's also very, very young. And that's it mentally, very emotionally naive. And he decides he's going to take his revenge. So he is going to turn the smugglers in to the authorities, which he does this. And he escapes, and he ends up... in a cottage with a woman, Elizabeth, who is saintly and just and very sweet. And she says, look, what you did was wrong, because you turned him into the, you know, the smugglers into the authorities, you know. But what you did is right, sorry. You turned the smugglers into the authorities. That's the right thing to do. You did it for the wrong reasons. You did it because you were irritated with them. But it is the right course of action. These people are criminals. You must follow this through to the end. So he thinks, okay, I mean, he's besotted slightly, so he thinks, okay, I will follow it through to the end. So off he goes to town to turn the smugglers in. And in town, he does get a bit sidetracked. He loses his will to go forward, and he meets Lucy, and she does turn his head slightly, but he manages to get himself back on track. He does turn the smugglers in, but actually it makes no difference. The smugglers get away. So then, of course, he knows that he mentioned Elizabeth's name in court, and he knows that she's in danger. So he runs back to the cottage. And sadly, it all goes horribly wrong. Elizabeth actually takes her own life. I think it's in the book she takes her own life, and there's a scuffle in the film. So what happens now, slightly the three things, again, diversify. So in the novel, the authorities come in, and it's actually his knife in her. So they arrest Andrews, and he confesses. He actually says, even though he didn't kill her, he confesses to it. But in the film, what happens is they get taken off, and they are actually, it's part of a bookended series. So the film starts with Redgrave being tortured and ends with Redgrave again. So what happens is the authorities don't know what Carleon looks like, so they have no idea. So they're saying to Andrews, are you Carleon? They're saying to Carleon, are you Carleon? And eventually they both confess, but Carleon insists that he is Carleon, and he dies, and Andrews is free. So we hope that he goes forward and makes better choices in life. So it's quite a neat little story, really, and it does show Greene as a younger writer, but I think it is worth a look. What I found really fascinating about this particular story was actually the boxes, really, and the production element of it. So the credits tell us that it was adapted for screen by Muriel and Sydney Box. And the second script is available from the BFIR archive. There's no final script, no shooting script available. But the second script is actually amazingly similar to what actually ended up on a screen, even to the point of it says about reusing footage. So, and I think I read the script first, and I saw it first, and I thought, oh, that's odd. I've seen that scene before, because you notice when they're reusing stuff. And it's actually written in the script. So it says it may be practical to use a revamp of the Orchard of the Deceased. So they just plonked it back in. And the reason they did this was because it was part of a big production dynamic that the Boxes were doing. So let's see if I've got some details on this. Hold on just one moment. Yeah, it's not a perfect film because it does have sort of heavy voiceover sequences, and it feels very much like somebody has actually almost just cut chunks out of the book and slapped them into the screenplay. So why it feels like this is because it was part of an ambitious bid from the Boxes to promote the British film industry. In a rare profile of the producer in Picture Post in June from 1946, Box was contrasted with the vulgar showman of the past who drifted into movies in the early days from circuses and travelling burlesque and dubious promotions, but were now an outmoded type, lacking in culture and education. In this showman's place grew a new sort of filmmaker, which was Box, a man with the same kind of cultural affinities and background which we find in other sorts of cultural affairs, so more accomplished. So I thought that was quite interesting, just the idea of these showmen as well running the filmmaking industry initially. So after his success with The Seventh Fell, Box advertised himself as a man... who could revamp the British film industry. And I think it was, I can't find my notes on this, I'm just gonna go, yes. So he formed a company called Verity Films, and which was capable of producing 250,000 feet of completed film in a year. And I love the way they speak in feet as well, which is so different than how we would speak today. In fact, he wanted to do 15 films in a year. So you can tell that's why you're getting the studio production. That's why you're getting things being used again. That's why you're getting, in the Muriel Box's script, the feeling that bits have just been cut out of the script and put in there. So he did make 15 films a year, and three of them were going to be in spectacular Technicolor, and one of these films was The Man Within. And of course that was, sadly it's no longer available, sadly the version I watched is the black and white. So I thought that was very interesting, just the how the production process had such an impact. Also, the other thing was that they weren't going, I think they bought it and they had it for 2 years, and then they weren't going to make it, or they had no plans, it wasn't on the list. And then Shepperton Studios said, we've got a spare studio for 2 weeks, have you got anything you want to make? So it slotted in. So it really was quite a rush job in production. So at the same kind of time as that production was hitting the screens, there was a different kind of Attenborough also strutting the streets. And it was, of course, Pinky Brown. And here he is at the back. So the original title for Brighton Rock was The Worst Sin. So I don't know if that was because of Rose and the fact that she is being tried to, Pinky wants her to commit suicide, possibly, and she won't step over that threshold. But I do think it's a great title, although I also love Brighton Rock, of course. And what's very interesting in the Bolton Brothers film, which was made in 1948, or released in 1948, is the warning which comes at the beginning, which sort of says, oh, you know, Brighton used to be like this before the war, and it was terrible, and there was lots of violence, but now it's really nice. So I love that sort of addition that had to be added there. It is considered as a masterpiece, quite rightly so, I think. But Green had concerns over the portrayal of Ida by Hermione Bradley. There is a certain clowning element. In fact, she's even dressed as a clown at points in the film. So he didn't really approve of that. Rowan Joffe's version, which is 2010, Helen Mirren has the leading role of Ida, and there are some wonderful performances by Sam Riley and Andrea Risberg as Rose. And I think although people didn't like it initially, I think it is a really beautiful film, and it's beautifully graded and it takes things in a slightly different way, but it's still definitely worth watching. And interestingly, when Joffe was asked to make the film, he was actually asked to make an adaptation of the Bolting Brothers film, not an adaptation of the book. And he said, I can't do that. I'm not gonna even go there. And then he read the book and he said, yeah, but there's more here. I can hold on to this. So he did go ahead with it. And it's difficult, you know, Green was felt that the religious element was watered down in the Bolting Brothers film, which it has been slightly. It's very difficult to, especially in 2010, to get those sorts of meanings for what might be a predominantly secular audience as well. So things change with time. The audience changes their expectations. And with adaptation, you probably need to drop certain things. Although it would be nice to keep the element, that Paradise Lost element, which is definitely in Brighton Rock, to try and keep that going through, I think would be good. What you've also got in the films that we've looked at so far, in three of them, is you've got these dislikable men. So Andrew's in the first film that we looked at, The Man Within, he is dislikable, intensely dislikable. Pinky, of course, intensely dislikable. And Raven, who I think is slightly more likable, but still not that nice. So they are particularly dislikable men. And I think there are certain themes which run through Green's work, which are really interesting. And I want to unpick that in my PhD and just look how those can be carried forward as well. So I think it's really interesting that he returns to these same themes, really. And this is from the Joffe version, and it's really, I thought, you know, the three men that I've just mentioned, Pinky, Raven, and Andrews, they are men not to fall in love with, definitely. And if you could say to Rose, don't fall in love with any of these men, you really should. So what is a masterpiece in both the novel and the film, but is completely different, is the endings. So I just want to read you the ending of the novel. So this is Rose, she's going back to the house, Pinky is dead. There was something to be salvaged from that house. His voice speaking a message to her. If there was a child, speaking to the child. If he loved you, the priest had said, that shows. She walked rapidly in the thin June sunlight towards the worst horror of all. I mean, I think it's got to be one of the best endings in a book ever. But equally, the film version, and the two film versions are pretty similar, the Bolting one and the Joffe one. So I'm just going to read the 1948 one. Oops, it's refreshing, sorry. I think we've gone off slightly track here. Okay, if I can find it. Okay. This is the 1948 one. So Rose is in a convent with the nun, and the nun said, I should just, in case anyone hasn't read this book, which I'm sure that you have, of course, Pinky records on the pier, he records this message to Rose. She thinks he's recording a message of love, and he says, you think I'm gonna say I love you, but, and then there's this vitriolic outburst. So in the 1948 film, Rose is in a convent with the nun, and the nun says, there's always hope. It's the air we breathe. And Rose plays Pinky's record and it gets stuck on I Love You. So I think that's, again, a masterful ending. So there we have two endings which are completely different. And they were right, and Green could see that the ending he had in the novel was not going to work for a film. So sometimes being a pragmatist, which Green was about adaptations, is really a good thing to have as a writer. So another thing that we have in Green's stories are political backdrops, these these very specific political backdrops which can actually tie a novel into place. Or we think they can tie a novel into place. So we've already got a barrier up against its adaptation. So as I said before, the Malcolm Bradbury quote, "An adaptation like the work it adapts is always framed in a context, a time and place, a society and a culture." So three of the, I mean, there are many of them with political backdrops, as we all know, but certainly these are: The Power and the Glory is about a renegade priest living in Tabasco at a time when the Mexican state were attempting to suppress the Catholic Church. So then we've got The Quiet American, which of course we all know the political backdrop there, and that was changed slightly in the 1955 version to be more anti-communist, which I think is the one that we're watching tonight, isn't it? So that will be really interesting to see that, and Green didn't approve of that. And the other one we've got there is The Comedians, which is set in Haiti about Papa Doc. And so those films we all might think would be very difficult to adapt, to transpose to a different time. But as we know, Shakespeare's work is continually being adapted. So possibly, I hope that, in a way, I hope that they don't, because these political backdrops are awful. But perhaps they can be adapted or can be revisited and changed. Sometimes we don't feel that's necessary, but to keep the name of Graham Greene alive, it's good to have these things coming out, I think. So one that did get changed quite a lot was England Made Me, not actually changed in the script, but changed in the setting. So it doesn't start off in grimy old London, it starts off in the south of France. And then it goes to Germany. So in the book, it goes to Sweden, and it's all set around the lake, and it's about the financial markets. And in the actual 1970s film, it was 1973, it's much more about the rise of fascism and the Nazis. And it's actually quite, that political element is quite heavy-handed in the film. I think I missed Sweden, so I don't know if anyone else felt that, but I certainly missed the lake, and I missed the financial markets rather than the rise of fascism. But it's good to play with these ideas and pick out different ones, and there is no definitive interpretation. I think that's nice to have different ones, really. So, and of course, Our Man in Havana, which we all know is set in Havana, but he actually initially set it in Estonia. So again, that seems really odd to us because we all associate it with being in Havana. I can even hear the music in my head. But things can be changed. Sometimes without adaptation, we just try on different things and see if it works. So let's have a look at the ones that Green did think worked and why. And definitely the sort of, even when they worked, there was a degree of pragmatism that he held, which was fantastic. So this is, of course, The Basement Room, The Fallen Idol, which was an absolute success. It was directed by Carol Reed. It was from a short story. And Green did actually say that it's easier to adapt something from a short story. I don't know if that's always true or if it's partly the relationship that he had with Carol Reed. My feeling is that the relationship is part of the adaptation process, which worked so well. So they had 10 days where they went off and they did what we would call dramaturgy on it. And they went through scenes and they did dialogue and they acted things out. And as a writer, it's exactly what you want to be doing. You don't want to be in a room with lots of people. You just want to be one person, the director, who has the power to make the changes and work and play about with the script and different things in it. So Green claimed that this was unfilmable, this project, because it was too bleak, a murder was committed by the most sympathetic character, and it had an unhappy ending. And of course, the elements in that were changed to encompass that. So I think it's really interesting that that worked so well, and I think it's part of the Graham Greene, Carol Reed process. And I think that process is really valuable for people who are going into adaptive theory. So, of course, the other one is The Third Man, and this was reverse engineered in some ways because he wrote this as a treatment, then it became a film, then it became a novel. So you can see that he's playing about with the form quite a lot. And in 1999, the BFI voted this the best film of all time. So it's obviously stood the test of time. That dramaturgical process really worked. The other one is The Tenth Man, which I'm not going to speak about again, but this was quite interesting. It was lost in the studio vaults. It was just a short, it was a treatment again. So film treatment is like a short story. So it was lost in the studio vaults. He thinks it was about 1937 that he wrote it, and it was eventually filmed in 1983. He doesn't actually, although the article that we saw earlier, he would have given that article after this particular film. He doesn't comment on this film, so I don't know what he felt about it, but I'll investigate that one. So this is something that I watched really recently, which I actually loved. I have to say, I spent a wonderful afternoon at the BFI with it. And this is adapted by Graham Greene, and it's also was adapted recently to Loser Takes All, and this is the production with Glynis Johns. And it's been adapted recently in 1989 as also Money Talks. It is a lovely, it's a rom-com, that's what it is. So it's genre fiction, which makes it very easy to adapt. And the adaptation and the novel are very, very similar. Apparently, I read the other day that the novel was actually serialized in a magazine, so I don't, yep, I'm getting nods. So it was serialized in a magazine. So that's interesting as well, just the form of it. So the two, the novel and the film, the 1955 film, are very similar. In the novel, they go to a restaurant. This is one difference, which I thought was quite sweet. And if you've seen the posters for it, you'll know what I mean. So in the novel, Glynis and Rosano Brazzi, they go to a restaurant up in the hills, and they take a car up to the restaurant. So in Graham Greene's script, they both have Vespa scooters, they both have their own. And in the final film, they're both on the one scooter. So that was just one difference, but there are very, very few differences. One thing that I would say is the casting is a bit off. There's supposed to be a young man that Glynis Johns kind of flirts with in the casino, and he's kind of the same age as Rosano Brazzi. So that, there's an element in there, a narrative element, which you lose because of that particular casting. So again, you can see how important the whole production process is. So what is the future for adaptation studies and for adaptations of Graham Greene? What I've been sort of saying here is that adaptation does have, there is a possible theoretical approach to it. I think that dramatological processes are really healthy and we should do those much more. And so that means bringing the writer actually into the process. Often the writer is shut out, if the writer is there. Otherwise, you bring the adapter in. So it's the person who has the integrity to keep that whole project locked in one place. And then they can play with the elements. Then you get the space to play. But you need somebody to have that concrete interpretation there. For Graham Greene adaptations, well, yes, they can be updated, they can be changed, and they could be reworked for a modern audience. That would all work. I also think that a biopic of Graham Greene, who spanned every decade of the last century, would be amazing. So I think that would be the way to go forward with things. Robert Icke, the playwright who did, I don't know if anyone saw The Doctor, when it was on at the West End. It was an amazing performance. It was an adaptation of Schnitzer's Professor Bernhardi. And he said that adaptation is like using a foreign plug. You are in a country where your hairdryer won't work when you put it straight in. You have to find the adapter which will let the electricity of now flow into the old thing and make it function. So I think that's what we need to be doing. And really, we need to be talking and not pointing fingers. I did want to get a photograph where he wasn't pointing a finger, but I thought that was so lovely and such glorious technicolor that is what you got. So thank you, everyone, for listening. I really appreciate it.
Surely that was terrific. Thank you so much. So it takes us off the usual beat of Graham Greene discussions. And we have, we're up against the clock a bit, but I'm just wondering if we have time for one or two questions. Would someone like to ask? We'll start here.
Thank you. Thanks, Sheila. That's fantastic.
Thank you.
Going back to your pie chart at the beginning, you've got six segments there. Just occurred to me as you were going through whether there's a seventh segment, which is the censor stroke film classification people.
Yes.
The censor idea came to mind in relation to Green's comment on 21 days, the censor wouldn't allow that. So he put that to one side. There's no way we could have that in the final film from the Galsworthy story. Brighton Rock, I think there was the original Brighton Rock, there was some interaction with the censor there about what could and couldn't be said about Brighton.
Exactly.
And I was just thinking about last night's film, the 1999 End of the Affair, which was given, I think, an 18 certificate in the cinema, and Stephen Woolley, the producer, was really narked, apparently, because it was given an 18 because of the very explicit sex scenes in it, and he thought they lost a huge segment of audience because they couldn't get a 15 certificate, which is what they were asking the classification people to do. But equally, he didn't want to compromise what Neil Jordan had done by in some ways toning down or editing the finished film. So there are three examples I'm thinking off the top of my head. In Green's case, where some combination of this external business of the sense of the film classification people actually becomes a factor in what ends up on the screen. Yeah. Sorry, that's a very long question which hasn't ended up as a question, but...
No, I love that. So thank you, Mike. I will look at, I'll put that on my pie chart. I think that's great. It's a very valid point. Yeah, they're the gatekeepers, aren't they? Yeah, wonderful.
Thank you very much. It was really interesting. Cute. Thank you. But my question was, why not Hitchcock?
Why not Hitchcock? I like Green better when I.
Why did he not want
Hitchcock? Oh, right. Okay. Right, okay, now I get you. He didn't like Hitchcock's films. He felt they were melodramatic. Yeah, I think that's right, isn't it? Melodramatic. Yeah.
He also said that Hitchcock had not did enough.
Oh, right, okay.
For one of Green's books that he wanted to adapt.
Right,
and
okay.
So use that as part of his
experience. Right, yeah.
I was just adding a detail. I mean, what Shirley says, I think, is correct. Green just didn't, from the 1930s onwards, didn't rate Hitchcock. But there was a specific event in the 50s where Hitchcock made a bid for one of Green's books to put it on the screen. And Green said no, he didn't bid enough. It just wasn't a big enough bid, so we rejected it. So we added that, I think, as a bit of an excuse.
Mm. Lovely.
I throw in one thing that in the late 30s, Green looked to Hitchcock for scriptwriting work, and it didn't work out. So
right. Yeah. There was obviously a bit of a personality clash going on there, I think.
I think we're right on time now, and perhaps it's a moment for a coffee. Thank you so much, Shirley.
Thank you. Thank you.